Good evening, good to see you, and welcome to Calvary Chapel Anaheim. And we're getting into His Word tonight once again. We're going to finish up what we had started last week. And remember, I'd asked you to bring your stuff. Remember the charts that I had you in? Some of you thought, what chart? I don't remember any chart. Yeah. Well, that's why I made extra copies here, for those of you that didn't get it. And I see that Jim Gauthier is not here tonight to hand them out. So, but we have... this green one, I made different colors. That last week there was a little confusion. Yeah, that's that one right there. It's on front and back, there's two charts. I'm gonna explain this tonight. It looks a little complicated, but those of you that didn't get one, John will see to it that you get one. And then there are two maps, and I made two different colors this time. They're actually different. One's Daniel 11, verse 40 to 43, and then the other one's Daniel 11, verses 44 to 45. And they are different. So if you don't have this, I'm going to have John make sure you get one of each. So when you, what, yeah.
These are the same as last week?
Those are the same as last week. So if you already got last week's, what I handed out last week, I'm really handing it out again. There's going to be one exception. Everybody's going to get this yellow copy, which is the, which are the Old and New Testament allusions to Antichrist. Okay, does everybody have one? Anybody not get one? Okay, good. Praise the Lord. I think we're set. Now, tonight is a unusual. I like to get, and last week was that way too. In fact, the last part of Daniel is more of an academic, as you already know. If you haven't noticed by now, there's a lot of academic, mind-stimulating type study. And it's good for you. And God really, Jesus told us to understand this. And in Matthew 24:15, he admonishes the reader to understand about Daniel 9 and the abomination that caused desolation. And that's what we're doing. We're just doing what he told us to do. So it takes a little work, and he expects us to put in a little work, right? I mean, you know, being in the Christian walk is not a skate. It's not a skate. It's hard work. So I want to encourage you with that as we go now into this last part of Daniel 11. Just to, in review, just a quick summary of chapter, thank you, John. A quick summary of chapter 11, verses 1 and 2 cover the Persian Empire. Those two verses describe the coming of the Persian Empire. Verses 3 and 4 describe the coming of the Greek Empire. 5 through 35, probably one of the most boring passages in the whole Bible, but yet, at the same time, one of the most exciting passages in the Bible, because there's well over 100 prophecies in these verses that were fulfilled to the very detail. And you received a copy of that last week. A summary of that, of course, those verses don't give the names of the kings. It just describes them as the king of the south, the king of the north. Secular history gives us those names, and we see how they just tie in together beautifully. And then verses 36 to 39, we studied in detail last week, regarding the willful king, or aka Antichrist. And then finally in tonight, we're going to finish up with verses 40 to 45. These verses here, Daniel 11, verses 40 to 45, are huge. They are give us a big picture of the end times, of the final conflict that we refer to as the last 7 years. Described in Daniel chapter 9, verse 27, tells us about a king, a prince, who will come to confirm a covenant with many for 7 years. In the middle of that seven-year period, he breaks his agreement, and he goes into the temple, and he makes himself God. He declares, we know from 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 4, that he will declare himself God, make himself to be God. And so that's a summary. Tonight we're going to focus in on that. Last week, as I mentioned, we studied the willful king. But before we get to that, I want to read with you. And I'm just going to read over these verses with you so you get sort of a feel of where we're headed tonight, the essence, the big picture. Beginning in verse 40 of Daniel 11, I'm reading from the New International Version. At the time of the end, the king of the south will engage him in battle, and the king of the north will storm out against him with chariots and cavalry and a great fleet of ships. He will invade many countries and sweep through them like a flood. He will also invade the beautiful land, Many countries will fall, but Edom, Moab, and the leaders of Ammon will be delivered from his hand. He will extend his power over many countries. Egypt will not escape. Verse 43, he will gain control of the treasures of gold and silver and the riches of Egypt, with Libyans and Nubians in submission. But reports from the east and the north will alarm him, and he will set out in a great rage to destroy and annihilate many. He will pitch his royal tents between the seas at the beautiful holy mountain, yet he will come to his end, and no one will help him. Now, what I'd like to do is break down these six verses into something that we can get our hands around. And in order for us to really understand these six verses, we should break it up into little pieces and then put those pieces together so that we have a better idea. There is a little bit of ambiguity in these verses, because it's not real clear, as we shall see, who the he is. And so scholars debate over who the he and the him are in this passage. But first of all, I'd like you to notice the phrase back in verse 40, that the phrase time of the end. Now, last week we saw in verse 35 of chapter 11, Daniel, look at verse 35 of chapter 11. It reads, some of the wise will stumble so that they may be refined, purified, and made spotless until the time of the end. There's that same phrase, time of the end, in verse 35. It says, for it will still come at the appointed time. This phrase, time of the end, is a very important phrase. And we know that the time of the end also has other uses in the Old Testament, other phrases that give a similar meaning. The latter days and the latter years. They basically mean the same thing. Latter days, latter years, time of the end. They mean the same thing. Now, the context determines what it means exactly. When you got to read the phrase in context. So in this case, the context is dealing with the coming Antichrist, who the willful king, who we know the attributes described in verses 36 to 39 do not fit. Remember Antiochus the IV, Epiphanes, the description there does not fit him. And then as you read the verses in context to the last six verses, verses 40 to 46, you see that it fits better the last period of history, just before Jesus comes back to establish God's kingdom on earth. So here's how you should understand this phrase, the time of the end. Basically, not always, but basically in the Old Testament, the time of the end, or the latter days, or the latter years, refers to that period just before God's kingdom is established on earth. Okay, now 70% of Christianity will look at you blankly when we discuss this subject. We take the Bible pretty much for what it says at face value. We understand it in a literal manner, and that's not, we're not to be pegged as literalist in the strict sense of the term, but according to how you would just ordinarily read the text. And you take into consider, of course, the symbolism, symbolic words, the metaphors, the allegories. Not too many allegories, by the way, but symbolism, metaphors. The Lord loves metaphorical expressions. He loves symbolic phrases. He wants us to understand. Our faith is grounded in what he has to say, and behind these symbolic words are literal truths to help us understand who he is and what it is that he is doing. And if you remember when Jesus was speaking to the disciples, remember when he was presenting the kingdom to the people of Israel, and then the religious leaders in chapter 11 of Matthew rise up and accuse him of doing the miracles in the name of Satan. Remember that? And you cast out demons through who? The power of Beelzebub, the king of the demons. In other words, they accused him of being demon-possessed, and he immediately denied it. And then with that attack against him by the religious leaders, in Matthew chapter 13, he then begins to speak in parables. For you will be forever seeing, but you will not understand, he says. And I'm going to speak to you in parables, so that those who will understand, but those who won't. And that's just how he chose to do it. He was fulfilling what Isaiah said would come to pass, that they would see, but they wouldn't be able to understand. They would hear, but they wouldn't be able to understand. And so Jesus used the parables to describe the coming of coming of the church, if you will. The kingdom of heaven is likened unto, and then he begins to describe, make a transition into what is going to take place in the future concerning the coming of the church. And then by chapter 16 of Matthew, he actually there begins to, for the very first time, he mentions the church. He says, upon this rock, Peter's confession of faith, I will build my church. And the first time Jesus mentions the church. And this whole new shift comes, where Jesus then begins to focus the attention. He begins preparing the disciples for the coming of the church age, and a shifting away from the coming of the kingdom of God upon the earth as something to be postponed. And you all know, and I went over with you in Acts chapter 1, verses 6 and 7, when the disciples wanted to know, is it at this time you're going to restore the kingdom, Lord? Because remember, Jesus was just about ready to leave, and the disciples were looking forward to the coming of the kingdom. See, they still were a little dense. They still weren't getting what the Lord was explaining. He says, look at, Jesus said to them, it's not for you to know the times and dates that the Father has set, but you're supposed to just do what I tell you to do and go to Jerusalem, wait there, tarry there until the Holy Spirit comes upon you with power, dunamis power, so that then you can be my witnesses to Jerusalem, Judea and Samaria, and then to the uttermost parts of the earth. And God, his kingdom, it's going to come, but there's some issues that need to be dealt with. Israel and Jerusalem rejected Jesus, their Messiah. God has now put a delay, postponing of the kingdom, and that's where we're in what is called the time of the church, the period of a dispensation known as the dispensation of grace. Paul writes about it in Ephesians chapter 3. He describes the church there as a mystery, and we're in this period of time that is going to continue until he gathers the Jews back into the land. He regathers them back into the land, and then he pours his Spirit out upon them, and then he establishes his kingdom here on earth. Now, some of you are going to be surprised to hear me say, to describe what I just said, those three points, that is what the new covenant is. Did you know that? The new covenant, we're celebrating communion today. We're going to have communion a little later. Many of us think of the new covenant as communion, baptism, the church, and so on. But the new covenant has to do with the regathering of Israel back to the land, the Jews back to the land, then pouring out a Spirit upon them so that they will recognize him, that he in fact is Jesus. They'll recognize Jesus as their Messiah. And then number three, God establishes his kingdom on the earth at that point. That is basically the new covenant. And most Christians don't know that. But you see, the kingdom of God, which is the ultimate goal here, that God will establish here on earth, will not come until those three things happen. Okay, it's not going to be fully manifested for us to see. Now, this all takes place in the latter years, the latter days, or the time of the end. And that's what this phrase means here. And we saw that back in verse 35 of Daniel 11. And now we see it here again in verse 40 of Daniel 11, at the time of the end. Now, the Antichrist is a key figure that shows up toward the time of the end. And Daniel 11, verses 36 to 35, 36 to 39, gives us a description of Antichrist in a particular, well, let's look at verse 36. It says, the king, verse 36 of Daniel 11, the king will do as he pleases. That's why he's called the willful king. He will exalt and magnify himself above every god, and will say unheard of things against the God of gods. He will be successful until the time of wrath is completed, for what has been determined must take place. Now, this willful king, if you look on our chart here, right here, Daniel 11:36. He also has these 33 other titles that are listed in the Old Testament. And he has, and by the way, I made a copy of this for you. I told you I'd do that last week. I'm going to leave it up here for you to pick up afterwards, because you don't really need it right now. I want you to have the charts, though, and the maps. If you haven't already gotten a copy, you need one. Here are the New Testament allusions to Antichrist. Here are the most famous. Of course, he's taken on the name Antichrist for our culture. A better name for him would be the mouth, because he's boasting, always boasting about something. He's arrogant. Typical of a politician, too. If you think about politicians today, that's what they do. They boast about every, you know, what they've accomplished and how great they are. False prophet, man of sin, son of perdition. These are some New Testament allusions. Now, what I'd like to do is to walk through these verses with you once again. Daniel 11, verse 40 to 45. And I want you to notice something that I've inserted to help us sort of unravel the mystery of these six verses, because it is mysterious. You will find conflicts among many Bible teachers today on these six verses. And it all has centers around this word he. Starting right here, let's look at this verse. At the time of the end, the king of the south will engage him. Now we know at this point who that is, because verses 36 to 39 have been describing for us Antichrist. So he is the object that this verse refers back to. So at the time of the end, just before God sets up his kingdom on earth, the king of the south will engage him, that's Antichrist, in battle, and the king of the north will storm out against him, that's Antichrist, with chariots and cavalry and a great fleet of ships. I want to stop there real quickly. And why is the king of the north and the king of the south, why are they attacking Antichrist? Well, the reasoning goes something like this. Back in Daniel chapter 9, verse 27, it says that a prince will come who will confirm a covenant with many for 7 years. Okay, so this prince that is coming that we call Antichrist is in focus here, and he will be confirming a covenant with many concerning Israel. Israel will be the focus and the center of this covenant that he is making. Now, when it says that these countries will attack him, Antichrist, they're attacking him because he at this point is known as the defender of Israel, the protector of Israel and Jerusalem. So it'd be like the America. If Israel was attacked, America would not, at least historically, we would not just sit idly by and let them be attacked. If they needed our help, we would move right in to protect them, because there is this bond that we have with them. President Nixon, who, by the way, did not like Jews, but we do know that in 1973, when Russia was about to intervene in the middle of Yom Kippur War, President Nixon ordered our military on high alert, and he called then I think it was Brezhnev at the time, the leader of the Soviet Union, and told him, if you send your troops in there, we will send in ours. And so he challenged him. He challenged the leader of the Soviet Union at that time, and they backed off. And so here, that's an example of what this is about. If you attack Israel, you're attacking us. That's the idea here. So when it says the king of the south and the king of the north attack him or attack Antichrist, it has the context, the relationship has to do with Antichrist, who had entered into confirmed a covenant with Israel, that he would be protect that covenant. So that's the idea here, why we believe that he, Antichrist, is really referring to the covenant that he made with Israel as described back in Daniel chapter 9, verse 27. Now, it starts to get a little complicated here after this first part of verse 40. When we get into that last sentence, it says, he will invade many countries and sweep through them like a flood. Now, we're not sure who the he is here. We're not sure if that's referring to Antichrist or referring to the king of the north. Because when you read it together, all together in one breath, it says, at the time of the end, the king of the south will engage him in battle, and the king of the north will storm out against him. Notice, how will the king of the north storm out at him? With chariots and cavalry and a great fleet of ships. It's describing there how the king of the north is going to storm out at Antichrist. And he will invade many countries and sweep through them like a flood. Now that sounds like it's still referring to the king of the north. When he comes in with his great cavalry, great fleet of ships, he's going to invade many countries and sweep through them like a flood. So it sounds like the king of the north. But on the other hand, it could be still, could be Antichrist coming in to defend Israel. He sweeps in against the king of the north and the king of the south. This is where they have the great conflict, right over who is this he. Let's go on and we'll see some more. In verse 41, it says, he will also invade the beautiful land. Who is that? Antichrist and the king of the north. Many countries will fall, but Edom, Moab, leaders of Ammon, will be delivered from his hand. Notice verse 42. He, who is that? Antichrist or king of the north? He will extend his power over many countries. Egypt will not escape. And then 43, he, there it is again, Antichrist or king of the north, will gain control of the treasures, the gold, of silver, and all the riches of Egypt and Libyans and Nubians in submission. But reports from the east and the north will alarm him. Who's the him? Antichrist or the king of the north? And he will set out in a great rage to destroy and annihilate many. And then finally, verse 45, he will pitch his royal tents between the seas and the beautiful holy mountain, yet he will come to an end, and no one will help him. So here's just sort of a broad paintbrush stroke of these six verses that you can see where our difficulty is. The difficulty is knowing who the he and the him is in these six verses. And what I'd like to do is present to you two positions that are conservative positions, but they're one position will be Calvary Chapel, where Calvary Chapel sees these verses, and then how Hal Lindsey sees these verses, and he doesn't see them the same way as Calvary Chapel. It's nothing to get upset or worried about. It's just really something that we don't know. God has made it somewhat difficult for some one reason or other, but let's go ahead and now... I have a map up here for you to look at. And I told you toward the beginning that we'd like to take these six verses and break them into pieces. Okay, we've already looked at the time of the end, and we've established that. We have a definition for that. We also have seen that there is there's a lot of confusion over who the he and the him is in those six verses. And now we're going to look at each one of the entities that will be invading: the king of the south, the king of the north, and the news that comes from the east. There will be reports that will come out of the east, and out of the north, that will alarm him, and we'll identify who that is as well. Now, in order to do that, Many Bible teachers, and most conservative Bible teachers who believe that the rapture will take place before the tribulation, believe that Ezekiel 38 and 39 is another passage that parallels this passage right here. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take you to Ezekiel 38 and 39, and I'm going to read key verses that will help us understand who the king of the north is and who the king of the south possibly might be. And so let's do that right now. Let's go, we're gonna first focus on the king of the north. Who is the king of the north? Daniel describes in verse 40 of chapter 11. Go to Ezekiel chapter 38, and we'll pick up at verse 1. Ezekiel chapter 38, and we're gonna pick up at verse 1. Now, it tells us here, Ezekiel says, "The word of the Lord came to me." Now, I want to point out something before we move on. Remember, we just defined the time of the end as that period of God regathering the Jews back to the land before his kingdom can be established on the earth. Well, in Ezekiel chapter 36 and 37, that's precisely what you read. You read in those two chapters, Ezekiel 36 and 37, God bringing the Jews back to the land, regathering the exiles that have been scattered all over the earth. And that's what those two chapters are all about, Ezekiel 36, 37. Remember the valley of the dry bones, and the bones coming together, and the sinew and the flesh going on the bones? That's a metaphorical or symbolic expression of God actually bringing the Jews, their physical bodies, back to the land. Now, the spirit is not upon them yet, just their bodies, the bones, the flesh, and so on, him bringing them back to the land to do his work in the end times. When we come to chapter 38, it continues the chronology. Chapter 38 introduces to us a major invasion of Israel in the end times, and it describes to us who the players are that come in to attack Israel. And if you look on the map here, you'll notice we got north, south, east, and west, and I put that there to give us a proper bearing. And you'll notice the names on the map are going to match what we're about to read. Let's look at Ezekiel 38, verse 1. The word of the Lord came to me, Son of man, set your face against Gog, G-O-G, the land of Magog. So he's setting his face against Gog and the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal. Now the word Hebrew for chief prince is R-O-S-H, Rosh. And many believe rather than in translating it this way as chief prince, it can be translated as a noun, in this case, Rosh, which we know to be an ancient name for Russia. In fact, in the Quran, Russia is referred to as R-O-S, Ross. So it depends on the translator. Some may see it as more of an adjective for Meshach and Tubal, but anyway, nonetheless, let's move on. So Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal prophesy against him, against who? Gog, who is from the land of Magog, Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal. And we look on our map here, Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal basically are those peoples who descended from Japheth, described for us in Genesis chapter 10. Genesis chapter 10 is known as the Table of Nations. There we learn that the nations of the world basically came from 70 major families who came out of Shem, Japheth, Shem, and Ham, the three sons of Noah. You learn that in Genesis chapter 10. The names here, except for Rosh, Magog, Meshach, and Tubal, are all descendants of Japheth that we know migrated north. Okay? So let's read on. And then it goes on to say, I will turn you around, verse 4, and here he's speaking to the leader of these tribes, who is Gog, G-O-G. I will turn you around, put hooks in your jaws, in Gog's jaws, and bring you out with your whole army, your horses, your horsemen fully armed, great horde with large, small shields, all of them brandishing their swords. And then verse 5, we are introduced to some more nations that join Gog and his clans. Verse 5, Persia. And that's the first of a long list here of countries. And whenever the law of first mention in the Bible is very important, the law of first mention, whenever there's a list and whatever's mentioned first in that list, there's usually significance behind the mention of that first name. And there's a greater importance to it. So Persia there, Cush and Put will be with them, all with shields and helmets. Also Gomer with all its troops and Beth Togarma. From, now I want you to notice, we're asking who's the king of the north? Notice, from the far north, with all its troops, the many nations with you. So when does this happen? Get ready, look at verse 7. Be prepared, you and all the hordes gathered about you, and take command of them. Verse 8, here's when it happens. After many days, you will be called to arms in future years, and that can also be translated in latter years, like the King James translates it. In latter years, you will invade a land that has recovered from war, whose people were gathered from many nations to the mountains of Israel, which had long been desolate. They had been brought out from the nations, and now all of them live in safety. So as we look at the list of names here, we see Persia, of course, which Persia and Iran until 1932, I'm a little confused on my dates, but just shortly after World War I, what was always known as Persia was changed to Iran. And in fact, there are people today who don't like to call themselves Iranians because they still see themselves as Persians. So the changing of the name of Persia to Iran was a relatively recent doing, but that region has been Persia for centuries upon centuries upon centuries. There's no question as to who this is. So Persia, we read about Persia, we read about Gomer. Gomer's a little harder to nail down. Ashkenazi is a related, real close relative of Gomer, and we know about the Ashkenazi Jews out of Germany and Poland. So many believe this is part of Gomer. And remember, Rome never conquered Germany. Rome never conquered Germany. We'll come back to that. Togarma, many associate with Turkey and Armenia. And then Put is northern Africa. And Cush is basically the Sudan and Ethiopia. Cush is the Upper Nile. And we'll come back to that. Now, we're focused on the king of the north. Who's the king of the north? Well, so far, if you look at Israel is the point of orientations. So we're Israel, whenever we say north, south, east, and west, it has to do with Jerusalem. In fact, Jerusalem is right where we measure north, south, east, and west. And so from Jerusalem, if you go north, where do you run into? You go through Turkey, Togarmah, and where? Moscow, Russia, right? Interesting, isn't it? Let's read on. Look at verse 15 of Ezekiel 38. We learn where they come from. You will come from your place, still speaking of Gog, okay? Gog is a focus here. You will come from your place from where? In the far north. You know what the Hebrew says there? The Hebrew says to the uttermost, as far north as you can go. Now, if you go further north than Russia, where do you end up? At the North Pole, right? There's no country up in the North Pole. Russia is the furthest north that you can go. Many Bible teachers and prophecy buffs were saying, oh, it's the Soviet Union. Well, no, the Soviet Union is made up of a number of countries, and they broke up, right, in 91. So they don't exist anymore. And but Russia is still there in the gray. That's Russia. Okay, so we know where. Look at verse 16. It says, verse 15, we're still in verse 15. You'll come from the far north, you and many nations with you, all of them riding horses, great horde and mighty army. Verse 16, you will advance against the people of Israel like a cloud that covers the land. When is this going to happen? In days to come. The King James Version says in latter days. O Gog, referring now, Gog's the leader, I will bring you against my land so that the nations may know me when I show myself holy through you before their eyes. The purpose of the Gog invasion is God is going to manifest through them himself so that many nations will know who he is, that he in fact is God. So the king of the north, oh, there's another verse I want you to check out. Look at Ezekiel 39. We're still focusing on who's the king of the north. Son of man, verse 1, Ezekiel 39, prophesy against Gog. There's still focus on Gog. Say, this is what the sovereign Lord says. God is sovereign. I am against you, O Gog, chief prince of Meshech and Tubal. You see the way this reads, it sounds like Gog is the chief prince, but it's once again probably referring to Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal. And I will turn you around and drag you along. I will bring you from the far north and send you against the mountains of Israel. So the king, this king up here, he comes from the north, but then there are some other nations from different directions that also join him. And that now takes us to the king of the south. We know, when we look at Ezekiel 38 and 39, we know from looking at a map, the king of the north basically would be this group of nations up here, Gomer, Rosh, Meshech, Magog, and Tubal, and Togarmah. They're coming from the north. See that? And the king of the north would be Gog. Okay, he's leading the invasion. And all Gog is like a title, like czar or emperor. It's the leader, the head dude. Okay, now, who is the king of the south? Look at Ezekiel 38, verse 5. We read Persia, and then notice, Cush and Put will be with them, all with shields and helmets. Now, Cush and Put, who are they? We know that Put, another translation for Put is Libya. And Libya, back in ancient times, was basically northern Africa. Northern Africa. Now, who is Cush? I mentioned earlier that Cush is the Upper Nile region, which is in the south. The Upper Nile region, the mountains are in the south, and if you go to the headwaters of the Nile, where do you end up, by the way? If you follow the Nile all the way back to the headwaters, you end up by the equator, don't you? Uganda, right? And there you have those huge lakes that from there, that they're way up high. Kilimanjaro is way over in that direction, 19,000 foot elevation. The waters go downhill toward the Mediterranean Sea, and they make up what we call the Nile River. Now, Cush were those peoples that the Egyptians always had trouble with. And they lived along the Upper Nile River region. Those are the Cushites. And today, if you were to look, and I don't show it here, but you see that purple area just south of Egypt? That's the Sudan. And that is where the Kushites lived, in what we today call Sudan, because the Nile River goes right on through Sudan. And if you go further, continue to go further south and a little bit to the east, you have Ethiopia. And those two countries combined is what we would refer to as Kush. So the king of the south very well could be a confederation of the northern North Africa and the Sudan and Ethiopia, or African coalition. How about the east? He hears, according to Daniel 11:44, he hears news from the east. Go to Revelation 16, verse 12. Revelation 16, 12. Oh, by the way, just real quick, while you're turning there, some say that Saudi Arabia is the king of the south. Look on the map. Saudi Arabia is the king of the south. It's a possibility. There's a problem with that, though. Saudi Arabia actually protests the invasion of Gog. They ask, have you come down to take plunder? And some try to make Saudi Arabia Kush, but it's really hard to do. And after all, Sheba and Dedan, which is ancient Saudi Arabia, or ancient Arabia, they actually protest the invasion. Revelation 16:12 describes for us the kings of the east. Antichrist or Russia or whoever that he is, he hears news from the east. And it says, the sixth angel poured out his bowl on the great river Euphrates, and its water was dried up to prepare the way for the kings of the east. Now there are four angels that are held bound at the river Euphrates. We learn that in Revelation chapter 9. Look at keep your finger in Revelation 16 and go over to chapter 9 of Revelation. And here we read about the sixth angel sounded his trumpet. Now, in Revelation 9, it says trumpets are being sounded. And the sixth trumpet that is sounded, he says, verse 14, the announcement came from the sixth angel who had the trumpet, release the four angels who are bound at the great river Euphrates. And verse 15, and the four angels who had been kept ready for this very hour and day and month were released to kill a third of mankind. So these four angels, and they're fallen angels, they're demonic angels, they're not good angels, that are held bound. They're held in chains, they're held bound to this river until time comes for God to give them the go-ahead, okay, release them, and then they do their havoc. They are involved with the drying up of the Euphrates River, and that clears the way for who? The kings of the east to come over, as we read. Now go back to Revelation 16:12, and there we read that the sixth angel poured out his bowl in the great river Euphrates, and the water was dried up to prepare the way for the kings of the east. Now, we assume that these two, the sixth trumpet and the sixth bowl judgment, have a correlation between the two somehow. We read in chapter 9 that the four angels that are held bound, they're called to be released so that a third of the world's population would be killed. And then when we get to the bowl judgments, which is the very end of the tribulation, there we understand that the river Euphrates is dried up to allow the kings of the east to come way toward Israel. Okay, who are the kings of the east? Well, we look on our map once again. Northern part of India, then you go right into the heart of China. Right into the heart of China. Of course, Japan is in the east. The kings, notice that when you look at Revelation 16, verse 12, it says the kings, plural, of the east. The kings of the east. So it's multiple kings that are involved with this one. So I'm setting the stage for you, and what we're doing right now is I'm giving you pieces of information to help understand how this all comes together, and then I'm going to give you two views. I'm going to give you Calvary Chapel's view, and I'm going to give you Hal Lindsey's view. That sound fair enough? They're both very conservative. We're really not that far apart, but we really are in a sense. We're both pre-trib, pre-mill. We both believe the rapture is going to happen before the tribulation. So we're sort of splitting hairs, I guess you would say, here as we move on. Okay, now, let's go back to Daniel 11, now that we've established this information from Ezekiel 38, 39 in Revelation. And chapter 11, verse 40, and it says this, at the time of the end, the king of the south will engage him in battle. Okay, so the king of the south, we believe, has something to do with Africa. and not Saudi Arabia, because Saudi Arabia actually protests the invasion of Israel by Gog. And I want to give you the verses for that. Ezekiel 38, verse 13, reads as follows. Sheba and Dedan and the merchants of Tarshish and all her villages will say to you, have you come to plunder, and have you gathered your hordes to loot and to carry off silver and gold and take away livestock and goods and to seize much plunder? So Sheba and Dedan is Arabia. The merchants of Tarshish and her, one translation, her young lions, may refer to England and the United States, because that's an interpretation. That's a real big interpretation. Some say, where do you see America? This is a possibility. In Ezekiel 38, verse 13, where it refers to the merchants of Tarshish and all her villages, those who came out of Tarshish. Who is Tarshish? Some believe that it's Spain, and the villages that came out of Spain are who? Basically South America and Central America, Mexico. And half of the United States actually came out of Spain. I mean, to be quite honest. England and the French, French took Canada, the England took the east coast of the United States. If you know your history, you can follow that pretty much. So anyway, so much for Sheba and Dedan, king of the south. Now, secondly, who is it that the king of the south engages in battle? And that's the big mystery. And I want to go into this now. And I have a lot of maps here. And that's, I handed out to you some maps. And it's either the Antichrist or it's Gog. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to walk you through this up here. And you can follow on your maps and mark your maps up however you want. But I'm going to first start out by giving you the seven-year timeline that we read about earlier that Jesus told us to understand. Daniel chapter 9, verse 27, Jesus told us that we're to understand concerning the abomination of desolation. There you go. Now, this seven-year timeline is the backbone of all Bible prophecy. Daniel 9, 24 to 27, Daniel 9, 24 to 27 gives us a timeline concerning the establishment of God's kingdom on earth. The establishment of God's kingdom on earth, where there'll be perfect peace that will finally come, comes at the end of this last seven-year period. Daniel 9, 24 describes a 490-year period, or 70 weeks of years, of which 483 years are already fulfilled with the coming of Messiah, who was cut off. Messiah was cut off. Daniel 9, verse 26 tells us Messiah was cut off, but not for himself. And then we read about the people of the prince who come will destroy the sanctuary, or the temple. And we know that was Rome in 70 AD. They destroyed the temple in 70 AD. 70 AD occurred approximately 35 years after the Messiah was cut off. That tells us that there is a gap of time between the end of the 483 years described in Daniel 9, 26, 24 to 26, and the last 7 years described in verse 27 of Daniel 9. Now, I know we're stretching our brain cells a little bit right now, aren't we? So that's okay. We are still waiting to see fulfilled that last 7 years of Daniel that has not yet been fulfilled. Here's how that last seven years breaks down. It's basically broken down into 2 3.5-year increments. Why do we divide it up that way? Because that's how the Bible divides it up. Revelation speaks of 42-month periods. And in the middle of that 42, that seven-year period, the Antichrist goes into the temple and declares himself God, according to 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 4, and Matthew 24, verse 15. Jesus said, when you see the abomination that causes desolation go in the holy place, then you're to get out of Jerusalem. The Jews that are there, get out of Jerusalem. That tells us two things. The Jews are in the land, and secondly, the temple has been rebuilt. Two very important things. Okay, that takes place in the middle of the tribulation. How do we know that? because we know that Daniel 9 verse 27 tells us that the ruler who makes the covenant with many for 7 years, he breaks it in the middle of the 7 years. We place that right here, right in the middle, and we correlate that verse, Daniel 9:27, with 2 Thessalonians 2:4, where Antichrist declares himself God in the temple. Okay? Now, let's walk through this one step at a time. I'm gonna present to you first Calvary Chapel's view of how to understand Daniel 11 verses 40 to 45 in context with Daniel 9 verse 27. Here's our 7 year timeline. And the Roman ruler confirms a 7 year covenant with many at the beginning of that 7 years. Now, already we have a little problem. And that is that we don't really know when it is that the covenant will be implemented. It's one thing to confirm a covenant. It's another thing to implement the covenant. Are you with me? Many times, those of you in a labor union, you draw together a contract and you agree upon the terms and you say, okay, this is how we're going to do it, but it's not going to start until such and such a date. That's the idea here. And so we don't know when that is. We know that there's a gap of time between the confirming of that covenant and when it is actually implemented. Now, the question that we want to ask is, when does the Lord come back? And oh, I see that we have a, there we go. When does the Lord come back? Well, those of us that believe in the imminent return of Jesus Christ, okay, and how many of you believe in the imminent, that he can come at any moment? Okay, now you know most Christians don't know the verses to justify that. They know they believe it, but they don't know why they believe. They don't know the verses. I'd like to get into that with you sometime. One of them, of course, is Jesus said in John 14 verses 1 to 3, in my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you, and I'm going to come back and I'm going to get you and take you to be with me where I am. Okay, so there's going to come a time when Jesus is going to come back to get his church, to take them to be with him where his Father is. And this is before the kingdom set up. But he didn't tell us exactly when that would be. He just told us, you know, be looking for me, be ready. You don't know the hour that I'm going to show up and so on. And so many of us are familiar with those verses. But we don't have time for that. That's an assumption here. The imminent return of Jesus Christ is critical to your belief that the rapture will happen before the tribulation. It's very critical. If the imminency is not taught in the Bible, we don't have a very strong leg to stand on concerning the rapture taking place before the tribulation period. So imminency is very important for us in order to establish the fact that the rapture is going to happen before the tribulation, before the last 7 years. Now, the departure from the faith is, we learn about in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 3. And the question is, in 2 Thessalonians, we learn two things must happen before Antichrist is revealed. There'll be a falling away or a departure from the faith, and there will be a second thing. Before the day of the Lord begins, there are two things that need to happen. A departure from the faith and the unveiling of Antichrist. Okay? Two things, according to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. The departure from the faith and the unveiling of Antichrist, the revealing of Antichrist. Now, there are those who believe that this description there in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 3, the departure from the faith, may actually be a departure of the church in the rapture, like Chuck Smith. He believes that's a possibility. Now, after there's a departure from the faith, then the Roman ruler, the Antichrist, is revealed, okay? And how is he revealed? We are not absolutely sure. There are assumptions in how he's revealed. One of them is the fact that he confirms a covenant with many for 7 years. There's a little problem with this. If he confirms a covenant with many, are you with me? Which one is he? Which one is he? If there are many leaders involved in the confirmation of a covenant, he confirms a covenant with many. Which of these leaders is he, if there's a number of them? We may not really know. which one he is. But in time, he will be revealed as to who he is by the fact that he does seize power and take control. And he seizes three of them, according to Daniel. Remember Daniel 7 we studied. He seizes three of the kings. He imposes his rule upon them by force. And then he gets the other seven, the rest of the ten, to follow in his train. Those of you that are new, that haven't been following this, get Daniel 7. You'll have to go back and get some of Daniel, the other chapters, because I'm putting together now what we've been studying for quite some time. Daniel chapter 7 and 8 and on. Now the Roman ruler who is revealed at this point is before the day of the Lord. Now, oh, I forgot to mention, when the Roman ruler, the Antichrist, is revealed at this point, I believe that is the first of the seven seals described in Revelation. The rider on the white horse with a bow, that takes place when the Roman ruler, the Antichrist, comes on the scene at that point. And that's consistent with Calvary Chapel's view. Now, the restrainer is removed before Antichrist is revealed. The restrainer is described for us in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, in verses 6 through 8, we read that there is a restrainer who is restraining the revelation of Antichrist. He's going to continue to restrain him until the restrainer is taken out of the way, and then Antichrist is revealed. There's a big question about who that restrainer is. Calvary Chapel takes a position that it is the Holy Spirit through the church that restrains Antichrist's actual being revealed to the people on earth. And so when the church is taken out, the Holy Spirit that indwells us is removed in a very unique way. Doesn't mean the Holy Spirit is gone altogether off the face of the earth, but the Holy Spirit's work will be different during the tribulation period than it is right now during the church age. It'll be much like the Old Testament, the way the Holy Spirit works throughout the earth. So when the church is taken out, the Holy Spirit is removed in a way that the church is salt and light to the earth. And then what happens? Would you turn it down? Oh, Helen's not here tonight. And so when the rapture happens, hey, special effects tonight. It happens before Antichrist is revealed and before the day of the Lord. Now, during this period of time, prior to the 7 years, there is a period of what is known as peace and safety. Antichrist has confirmed the covenant. Most everybody's pretty happy. A relative peace comes upon the world. It's probably at this time that the temple will be rebuilt. At least they'll start on it, get it going. And this is the period of the day of the Lord when it begins. And the day of the Lord, as we've studied a couple months ago, is very extremely important to this. And once again, we're not sure about how long that time gap is. We don't know. Chuck Missler suggested it could be 33 years long, so that when you take the 33 years and the last 7 years of the tribulation, you have a 40 years. And you know why he suggests that? How long was the first coming? From the time Jesus was born, right, until he died, 33 years. So some believe that the time between the rapture and his first coming, his second coming will be mirrored to the first coming, and that there'll be a 33-year gap between the rapture of the church and the start of the 7-year tribulation. That's pretty wild. I don't know that that's exactly how it's going to work. But, you know, the way things are slowly moving along here, and if you've been following prophecy like me since 1971, it seems like we're at a snail's pace, and 30-some-odd years have gone by, and it seems like we're still on hold. Well, that's not very long, 30 years. Think about it. I mean, 75, that was 30 years ago, 71, 33 years ago, 34 years ago. Didn't seem like that long ago, does it? So maybe, I don't know. And Oscar's shaking his head. I agree with him. I don't know if it'll be 33 years. We don't know how long this period of time is. That's the point. And God hasn't chosen to show us. So we'll just leave that open-ended. Now, Russia, according to Calvary Chapel, invades at the beginning of the 7-year period. And, this is when seals number 2, 3, and 4 open. That's what the red horse, the black horse, and the greenish-colored looking, the pale horse, are released quarter of the world's population dies with the fourth horse of Revelation, the four seals. That's when that starts. And the Roman ruler, now the question is, after Russia invades, at the beginning of the 7 years, they invade the Middle East, and we just read about that in Ezekiel 38-39, they're the king of the north that invades. And we know from Ezekiel 38-39 that they're wiped out, 5/6, according to the King James Version, of chapter 39, verse 1, verse 6, says that they are basically wiped out. Does a Roman ruler take credit for Russia's defeat and then solidify world power, peace and prosperity for the next 3.5 years, for these 3.5 years here where there's a relative period of peace upon the earth? Is that what he does? I'm not telling you. I don't know. I'm just raising it as a question. This is where Calvary Chapel leans in this direction, that it'll be work out this way. Then the Roman ruler, after this relative time of peace, breaks the seven-year covenant by entering the temple to declare himself God, causing the abomination of desolation, and the great tribulation begins, the last 3.5 years. This is when the opening of the seals number 5, 6, and 7 takes place, and the seven trumpets are sounded during this last 3.5 years. So seal number 5, remember, is the martyrs, those that die for their faith. Of course, Antichrist is probably going to have all-out war against Christians at this point, because he's now God, and anybody that goes against him, they're dead. And we know that they lose their heads, by the way. Revelation 20, verse 4, tells us that they were decapitated. They lost their heads. What religion does that today? Isn't that coincidental? I wonder how much of that plays into this. Or either the French bring back the guillotine. I don't know which one it is, but no, it's not the French. I don't think so, anyway. And then Armageddon, the seven bowl judgments, the very end takes place. The seven bowl judgments take place in a very short period of space. It would be impossible for them to be spread out. Why? Because the devastation is total. And Jesus said that unless he had cut the time short, everybody would have died. The bowl judgments are catastrophic. We know that a quarter of the world's population would have died at the beginning of the tribulation, and then another third of the world's population dies in the last part of the tribulation. That's half of the world's population. 6 billion today, that's 3 billion people. And boy, it's going to be tough. Now, I'm going to summarize these a little bit. I'm going to move the seals down here. And Daniel 11, verses 40 to 43, the kings of the south and the king of the north would take place when Russia invades at the beginning of the 7 years, Gog being the leader. And that would be the kings of the south, the African Confederation, Put and Kush, or Libya and Ethiopia, as described in your Bibles. And then the kings of the east and the north would invade here in the during the time of Armageddon, the actual battle of Armageddon. Now, I just sort of jumped ahead of you here. I want you to go with me to those verses now, and let's look at them. I'll do Hal Lindsey in a minute. And I don't really have much time left here, and I'm almost done. At the time of the end, verse 40, the king of the south will engage him in battle, and the king of the north will storm out against him. Now, this would be against, in Calvary Chapel's view, against Antichrist, with chariots and cavalry and a great fleet of ships. And he will invade many countries and sweep through them like a flood. Verse 41, he will also invade. Now, this is Antichrist. Calvary Chapel takes the point view that the he here is Antichrist, will invade the beautiful land. Many countries will fall, but Edom, Moab, and leaders of Ammon, which is today's Jordan, by the way, will be delivered from his hand. Many believe that this is where the Jews are going to escape and be kept safe by God in what is called Petra, which is in today's Jordan. And according to this passage, Antichrist will not have any power over this area. Edom, which is mentioned here, is where Petra is located. And Petra is going to elude the attack by Antichrist here, going to escape. we could do a whole hour just on that. So many countries will fall, but Edom, Moab, and the leaders of Ammon will be delivered from his hand. And I think it's going to be a supernatural event. Just as the Jews were protected from Pharaoh in the time of the Exodus, Once again, God will supernaturally protect the Jews from the attack of Antichrist. And they will go in there and try to attack Petra, and it's not that hard to find. I mean, you know, with GPS, it's no problem. You can find them. But they're not going to have success in taking them out, according to this verse right here. They will not have success. And the only way I can figure is Antichrist wants the Jews dead. He's not going to be able to do it because God's going to supernaturally protect them. It says in verse 42, he will extend his power over many countries. Egypt will not escape. Egypt, by the way, is a victim here. Egypt is going to fall victim to this man, and it'll be Antichrist, and he's going to take control of Egypt. And the Libyans and the Nubians, which would be North Africa and Sudan, they're going to be in submission. Now, we don't know what that means exactly, other than they're going to be following along, supporting it. They're going to be supporting the event. And by the way, the Sudanese and the Egyptians don't like each other. And isn't that interesting? That's pretty it. And they, down through history, they haven't gotten along too well. It goes way back. Very rarely has those two regions been united under one pharaoh, if you go way back. It's a very rare thing. But reports from the east, now here we go with 44. Reports from the east and the north will alarm him, and he will set out in a great rage and destroy and annihilate many. He will pitch his royal tents between the seas and the beautiful holy mountain, yet he will come to his end and no one will help him. Calvary Chapel believes this is Antichrist at this point. Okay, this is Antichrist. He moved in to protect the covenant that he had established when Russia comes in and the king of the south and the north come in and attack, and he moves in to defend it. And then while he's in there, he takes over the whole region. Now let's look on this at a map here. I got Hal Lindsey here. I didn't mean to do that. Well, let's do Hal Lindsey's real fast, okay? Hal Lindsey basically says, okay, first of all, he does not see Russia at the beginning of the 7 years, so let's get rid of that and place Russia at the beginning, at the middle of the 7 year period. That's when he believes Russia invades Israel, in the middle of the 7 year period after Antichrist declares himself God. Okay, also, the second seals number 2, 3, and 4 would be actually moved over here to the end. So the seals numbers 2 through 7 take place in the last 3.5 years. And so seal number 1 happens when the Antichrist confirms a covenant with many for 7 years. And the last 6 seals take place in the last 3.5 years, according to Hal Lindsey. Okay. Now, the peace and safety factor, according to Hal Lindsey, actually covers the whole first 3.5 years from the time that the ruler confirms a covenant. And according to Hal Lindsey, Daniel 11, verses 40 to 43, the kings of the south and north take place in the middle of the 7 year tribulation. And then at the very end, of course, verses 44 to 45. Now, Hal Lindsey does not see the he here as Antichrist. He sees it as Russia all the way through. He thinks this is the Russian all the way through. Look at verse 45. The Russians will pitch their royal tents between the seas and the beautiful holy mountain, and the Russians will come to his end and no one will help him. Hal Lindsey doesn't see Antichrist in here at all. He sees this primarily as the defeat of the Russians. And Antichrist is assumed to be involved in this. Now I want to show you, let's go, Hal Lindsey's view of the middle. This is how his view looks on a map, okay? He sees the Russian invasion at the middle of the tribulation period. So let's see that on a map. This is Hal Lindsey's view. Gog, Russia, the king of the north, and the king of the south, they come in to the Middle East, they take over, and they basically take over that area. This is then 3.5 years later, that's here at the end of the tribulation period. News from the north, that's verse 44 of Daniel 11, news from the north, which is the Antichrist, and news from the east, he becomes alarmed, Russia, or Gog. And Antichrist moves in, the East moves in, and boom, you've got Armageddon. Okay, that's Hal Lindsey's view. Now I want to show you Calvary Chapel's view. Antichrist comes actually at the beginning of the 7 year period, and Gog and Russia, it's basically the same as Hal Lindsey, only now we're at the beginning of the 7 year period. Egypt is not a part of Gog. Egypt is not a part of the Russian invasion. Okay, the king of the south does not include Egypt in this view. The king of the south is Libya is Put and Kush. Egypt and Kush are not the same thing. Kush is Upper Egypt, which is Sudan and Ethiopia. So the king of the south moves in, and the king of the north moves in, and Antichrist, now here's news from the north. Antichrist, this is not verse 44 yet. Antichrist goes in to protect the covenant that he had made, confirmed with many for 7 years. I want to show you something here, and this is really important. I want to go back. This is at the beginning of the 7 years. Russia invades Israel along with the king of the south. Antichrist, by this point, has already confirmed a covenant for 7 years. And so Antichrist moves in. But what's interesting about this scenario is that God destroys Russia in the mountains and the open plains of Israel, not the Antichrist. God is the one that does it, so that many nations may know that he is God. But does the world believe that? You see, there are going to be many nations that do. But Antichrist is probably going to take credit for defeating Russia and Persia. He's probably, this is a Calvary Chapel view, he's probably going to take credit for the defeat of Russia and Persia, and then he's going to establish himself in the region and possibly, and I this is my opinion, Persia, I believe Greater Persia is not just Iran, but may include Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon. Greater Persia may actually include Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon. Why do we say this? Because Iraq and Syria are not mentioned in the end times prophecy specifically. Damascus is mentioned as being destroyed, Isaiah 17 verse 1. Damascus is mentioned as being annihilated and destroyed forever. Okay, that's the only thing that we know of concerning Syria. Iraq is ancient Babylon. We don't know much about Babylon other than that it's possible Babylon could play a role in this only as part of revived Rome. Are you with me so far? Is it possible that Iraq, Syria, and Turkey, and Northern Africa are going to become part of revived Rome with Antichrist in control, and thus fulfilling what the Bible says will be the revived Roman Empire? This is a map of the revived Roman Empire that you see here, 120 AD. This is the extent of the Roman Empire. And you'll notice over here we have Iraq and Syria, and this is Parthia, this brown area. Rome never conquered Parthia, and Rome had a difficult time with Germany. But let's look at this. Past Bible teachers had taught that the revived Roman Empire includes this area that you see in the dotted yellow line. Remember back in 1956 when the Club of Rome came together, and then they began to say, oh, look at Rome's reviving, and it was mostly Western Europe. Now, since Soviet Union has fallen, and the Eastern European nations want to be part of that, now they're saying, well, now maybe it's Eastern Europe too. But why do we limit ourselves? See, what we're doing is we're looking at the details of today and we're reading the current events of today into the Bible. Why don't we just look at history and see what the Bible has to say? What about all of that? What about Northern Africa and the Middle East? That was part of ancient Rome. Why can't that be part of the revived Roman Empire that comes along? And is it possible? I think it is. When we look at our map again and we look at the order of events, we see the Russian, I'll do it one more time, the Russian invasion, the king of the south comes in according to Daniel 11 verse 40, and then the king of the north, which would be Gog, according to Ezekiel 38 and 39, they come in. The king of the south is also described in Ezekiel 38 and 39 as a northern, North Africa. And then this happens at the beginning of 7 years, so what does Antichrist do? Sit around and twiddle his thumbs? No, he's got to do something. So what does he do? He comes in. Gog is destroyed by who? By God himself. But Antichrist takes credit for it. He moves in. He's looked at as a hero. There's a relative time of peace for 3.5 years, the first 3.5 years of the 7-year tribulation. And there you have it. And then he begins taking over the Middle East with all of his great solutions and answers for all the money problems and all the oil problems. This guy has all the answers. I find it interesting today, do you know that the Muslims are looking for the Messiah? Did you know that? They call him the Mahdi. And they're looking for a Messiah who's going to come and reign for 7 years. Actually, they believe Jesus is going to reign for 40 years. Did you know that? Yeah. Now, the Shiites, which only make up about 20% of all of Islam, is located primarily where? In Iran and Iraq. Iran and Iraq are the majority of the Shiites are located. The Sunnis are everybody else. The Shiites are the ones who believe that the Mahdi is going to come, and he's going to come in the midst of a great turmoil. And Ahmadinejad, who's the president of Iran, what he's doing right now is he's stirring up trouble because he wants to be attacked. Did you know that? He wants us to attack him. And he's a good chess player, because if we attack him, it's going to cause problems for us. It's going to cause big problems for the United States. Now, if this is the time the Bible speaks of, is it possible that this man right now, this leader in Iran, is going to help precipitate what it is that we just described here? Is it possible that Persia, by the way, the leader of Iran, he has eyes on what? Iraq and Syria. He's looking to be the leader of Islam right now, to usher in the great era of peace that Islam claims it's going to bring. And then Jesus will come, Jesus is going to come, and when he comes back, he's going to kill all the unbelieving Christians and Jews while he's at it, so that there can be perfect peace, and Islam will rule the world. That's how they see it. Isn't it interesting that he has his eyes on this area right now? And this area is unclear in Bible prophecy, Iraq and Syria. It's unclear as to where it fits in the whole scheme of things. I have a deep down suspicion that that area is going to somehow fall into the hands of Persia. Their hearts are already with them. Why not? The only ones that are not with them are the Kurds of the north in Iraq. But the majority of the Muslims in Iraq are in favor of this man, okay, and support him. And all by the way, guess what other country is in favor? Lebanon. Hezbollah controls that country. Where does Hezbollah come from? Iran. So their tentacles are moving in. Persia's taking over. And then what we'll see is the king of the south, the king of the north, with Russia leading the charge. Persia will be right there. They're the first ones mentioned, remember, in that verse. Persia's number one. Law first mentioned. Antichrist will come in. God will destroy Russia, but Antichrist will take the credit. And then in the process, he'll convince people, hey, let's unify this while we have a chance, now that Russia's out of the way, and so on. And then he unifies that area. And then we've got the toes of the clay and the iron, the weak, partly weak, partly strong, and you have the scenario set up just as the Bible suggests it might. Now, this is speculation. I don't know what's going to happen this way. I don't know. But it seems like okay, so let me finish this up. Verses 44 and 45, Calvary Chapel sees the news from the north, or remnants from the north. That's on your map, remnants of the north. And the news from the east, that'd be the kings of the east, Revelation chapter 16, who will cross the Euphrates, and that is Armageddon. Any questions before we end? I know I threw a lot at you. No test. Well, that's for my Bible college class in South Bay. Huh? Where's the Euphrates? It's right. I don't know why this isn't working. Euphrates is right here. Yeah. Let's get some of this out of the way here. Okay. The Euphrates is right here. Goes right to the center of Iraq. What's Walbert's position? Similar to Hallinzi, sort of a combination of Hallinzi and us. He believes Antichrist will be unveiled when he seizes three of the ten by force, and he believes that's when Antichrist will be revealed, because he'll do that before the tribulation. Any other questions? I know I threw a lot at you. Go ahead.
What's this news from the north that Russia's already been founded?
Yeah, that's a good question. The news from the north. There will be reports from the north. Russia's 5/6 of Russia's defeated. And basically the military is gone. There's only but a sixth part left of it. But what I find interesting, to answer your question, is that it's that we hear about news from the north. Let me get there. it's news from the North. It doesn't say they invade, but news from the North. The question would be, well, are they actually able to assemble a military? But to me, the key to that question that you asked is the news from the East. Because at this point, they're still intact. And the Chinese and Russia are very close right now, right? You know how the Chinese, even they don't like each other, but they're close. And they're both supporting Iran. I think this makes, I mean, looking at what's going on today, it makes the most sense because the remnants that are left from Russia, those that are still there, and it's not just Russia, but Eastern the countries from Gomer and so on, Northeastern Europe, those that are still left, they'll agree with China, hey, let's move in and get rid of these guys that are trying, the beast, Antichrist, that's trying to take over. Does that make sense? Yeah. I'm sorry for being vague, but I think the kings of the East are going to have all the power by this time. And this is Armageddon at this point, when the Chinese, the nations, the numerous nations. And I think Persia, by the way, may be part of the kings of the East, what's left of them, the kings of the East. Persia, whatever's left of Persia, will be possibly part of it. Now, some believe that Islam, by this point, will have capitulated and humbled themselves to the leader of Antichrist. See, now that's one of the big questions I struggle with. How is it that Islam, which is a major obstacle to the Europe, how is it that they're going to all of a sudden become a team? How is that possible? Well, if they believe Antichrist is the Mahdi, along with the Jews believe that he's Messiah, then you have a solution to the problem. Because if you study Islamic eschatology, the study of end times for Islam, they believe very similar to the Bible as to this leader that's going to come on the world scene. And the leader of Persia right now, of Iran right now, believes that he's going to usher this guy in through starting the next world war. Some believe we're in World War III right now, but the next major conflict. Any other questions? I usually don't do the question and answer thing, but I thought I'd do it now because this is an academic kind of thing tonight. So. Now the Quran it has very little on prophecy, very little. It's the Hadith. The Hadith is where you get the end time stuff. So. No, the Hadith is actually a collection of Muhammad's sayings. The Quran was actually, according to their tradition, was written by God himself, okay, in Arabic. Okay, so God gave to Muhammad in Arabic the Quran. The Hadith is Muhammad's comments on the Quran, and they take that as second to the, it'd be sort of like our Apocrypha. Only that some hold the Hadith even a higher, equal to the Quran, like the Shiites. They will elevate the Hadith to equal level with the Quran, especially when it comes to end times. And that's exactly what Ayatollah Khomeini was the one who started this whole teaching about the great conflagration that's going to take place all over the world. And Ahmadinejad was one of his students. And now he's a leader. And some believe that the clerics in Iran right now are worried about this guy, that he has too much power. Because the clerics really run Iran. The clerics, the leaders of the religious arena run Iran right now. It's not Ahmadinejad. He's their puppet, but he seems to be coming on pretty strong right now, and I don't know how that's all going to work out. Any others? Yeah. Kurt?
Babylon is going to be a great economic problem at this time. And
yes.
As we've seen from other places, when they get very prosperous, they get very complacent. That's right in the center of the Shiite area. They may become tame because of their prosperity.
That's a good point. Wealth and prosperity tends to soften a people. Look at the United States. I mean, I hate to say it, but we're soft. We're not the same country as the 30s. We had a tough people come out of the Depression, and they could live on anything. And those people went and fought in World War II, and they were tough. I mean, they improvised just like that. They didn't have weapons. They figured how to do it. Now, we had God's grace. We don't want to rule out God's grace, but can you imagine the kids of the 60s now, you know, and the kids of the 80s and 90s? I mean, you know, we have a good army and we have the best technology, but you can't win a war on just technology. You've got to win a war from your heart and from your soul. And Islam has a heart and soul right now. And they can win it with cardboard cutters and plastic explosives, it looks like. You have to have a resolve to win a war. It's not technology. And that's what we're finding out, isn't it? Okay, well, we'll call it there. We went way over tonight, almost 8 o'clock.